This is Crime Connections. We're your hosts. I'm Leah.
And I'm Jackie.
Last week, we released the first part of a two-part series about the death of Tom LaHorsford. I know I ended it really abruptly, kind of on a cliffhanger, but I felt like that was the only way to do it without diving into everything that we're getting ready to dive into.
Yeah.
Yes. If you have not listened to part one, now is the time to stop. Take a second, go to part one, press play. Part two will be very confusing if you haven't listened to part one. You won't be able to follow along. Starting out, I want to take a few minutes to pause on the Tom LaHorsford case, and I want to just discuss the history of Forsyth County, which is where Tom LaHorsford was living at the time of her death. In 1912, there was an attack on a white woman in Forsyth County, and it was believed that an African-American man was responsible for this attack. There were five African-American men that were arrested for this crime, this attack on this white woman. They didn't know which African-American man committed the crime, so they arrested any African-American man that kind of fit the bill, and there were five of them. These men were kept in the jailhouse, and that evening, a mob formed, and the sheriff decided to leave the jailhouse.
Of course.
The jailhouse was only being guarded by a single officer, and I'm pretty sure it's obvious to everyone what happened next. The officer was overpowered, and the men that were being held captive were brutally murdered by the mob. I'm not going to go into the horrific details of it, but it didn't just stop there, murdering these five men. Months following these murders, the white citizens of Forsyth County branded themselves as the Night Riders. They threatened every African-American citizen that lived in Forsyth County to leave within 24 hours of receiving notice. So every night they would deliver a notice to a new African-American family or families. And if these families resisted the Night Riders or tried to put up any fight, they would drive by their home and shoot stray bullets into their house or their business until the message was loud and clear.
That is so crazy that at any time in the world that was a thing.
And it worked for a very, very long time. Forsyth County was only white citizens. There were no African American citizens. So now we're going to fast forward to 1977. And African Americans only made up about 26% of the entire population in Georgia as a whole. Forsyth County still was predominantly white. And if any African American family ever did move into that area, it was very obvious how the citizens felt. There have been family members that have come out like in the 80s and 90s that said when they moved there, they were the only African American family, and the terms that were used for them were extremely derogatory, and it was very obvious that everyone in Forsyth County felt that segregation was still appropriate.
That's so crazy, because that's not that long ago, if you think about it. Like, my mom was born in 69,
mm-hmm.
and she's 54.
Well,
so, like...
And when, like, when researching this case, I tried hard not to get sucked into such, like, a deep black hole when I was researching Forsyth County, but still to this day, there are a lot of things that have happened that make it very clear that the people in Forsyth County, a lot of them are still very much racist. It's just been very well hidden and covered up. So scary. The Horsfords were one of very few African-American families that lived in Forsyth County. And as mentioned previously, Tamla was the only African-American woman, and not even just the only African-American woman, the only woman of color at this sleepover. Every other woman at that party and man at that party, except Jose Barrera, they were all white.
Yeah.
So just kind of hold on to that as we continue this case, like the history of Forsyth, because it's going to make a lot of sense. When we ended with part one, Tamla's body had been discovered face down in the backyard of Jean Meyer's house the morning after their adult sleepover. Tamla was pronounced dead by the responding officers, and no life-saving measures were taken to try and revive her. Which, I just want to say, if there were no signs of life, no pulse or anything like that, it does make sense that they didn't perform CPR, but it does not make any sense why the paramedics were turned away, because paramedics are the ones that can declare time of death.
Yeah.
Police officers cannot declare a time of death.
Which, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's so strange.
Yes. And I thought, because I know that, that's the law here in Ohio. So I researched Georgia law, and by law, the time of death is to be determined by a qualified emergency medical service personnel before the coroner can take possession of the body. So already, the process is not being handled appropriately.
It's being handled how they want it to be.
Yes. When Tama's husband, Leander Horsford, was notified of her death, he was initially told that she had tripped over garden edging and suffered fatal injuries. Jean's Aunt Madeline had also once tripped over the same garden edging, but never suffered any type of fatal injury, like, whatsoever. So now the story that he's being given by police when they come to his door to tell him that his wife is dead is that your wife had a terrible accident. She tripped over some garden edging and succumbed to her injuries and died. Much different than
falling 14 feet.
Yeah.
And it'll be fine.
So at that time, Leander had a lot of questions, but the only thing he knew for certain was that his wife was dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she went for a sleepover and now she's dead. And now
she's just dead.
The official cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head and torso, consistent with falling around 14 feet from the balcony. According to the sheriff's office, blood testing determined that Tamla had been heavily intoxicated. I believe her alcohol level was like 0.238, which is like 3 times the legal limit, is what they said. And there were
kind of a lot.
Yeah. There were traces of marijuana and Xanax in her system. She also had numerous severe injuries to her head, neck, and torso, including a broken vertebrae and laceration to her heart.
Laceration to her heart.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of recount back to episode one, where a lot of the women that were at the party, though, did say that Tamla did not seem heavily intoxicated. Yeah. So it does kind of just make me wonder how.
Well, also another thing to think of, when the girl left, like the last person Bridget. Left for the night, she locked the door.
Yes.
She had the thought capacity to follow her to the door and lock it. Yes. And yet she's so heavily intoxicated she can't walk and Bridget falls over a huge...
Yes, and Bridget was the last person to see her alive, and she did go on record stating that she was not heavily intoxicated. She ate a bowl of gumbo.
And then
she was going to smoke one last cigarette and go to bed. Tamla's case was closed pretty quickly, like 3 months later, in February of 2019, and was ruled as accidental with no signs of foul play. But as we will come to find, her case was far from over. It seemed that for the most part, the family had their answer, and now they were just trying to lay Tamla to rest and make sense of such a tragedy. But people weren't staying silent. A lot of people were speaking up and saying that something didn't seem right. And it wouldn't take long for Tamla's family to really start questioning every single person that was involved in this case. The first red flag that was brought to the family's attention is that Stacy and Tom Smith, remember them, they're the married couple that insisted Tamla stay at the party and, by some accounts, took her keys from her. They left Jean Meyer's home minutes before the police arrived.
Which is very suspicious.
They were present when Tamla's body had been initially found, but they left before they could be questioned. And Jean's response was just, oh, I didn't think they needed to stay, so I told them they could just go on home and I would fill them in later. Once police were informed that they had left without being questioned, they called Stacy and Tom to come back to the home immediately. But by the time that Stacy and Tom made their way back, they had showered, changed out of their clothes, they were not wearing what they were wearing at the party, and they were all cleaned up.
Which is very, just so suspicious.
So like, suspicious. Like, because when I was researching, I completely forgot about them. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, Jean and Jose, like, what are you doing? And it totally went out of my mind that there were still women at this sleepover, mm-hmm. and that Tom and Stacy were there. And then I found it in the article that they had left and then were forced to come back. But when they took their time coming back. They didn't come back right away. They took their time. They freshened up. They changed their clothes. Then they came back.
That's crazy.
The reason why this information wasn't disclosed in the beginning is because the first officer on the scene, Corporal Miller, that we talked about, and the first investigator on the scene, Michael Christian, both had personal and professional relationships with Gene Myers and Jose Barrera, which,
of course,
in any other situation, that is an immediate conflict of interest, and they would have had to call someone else to come to the scene and say, I can't be here.
Yes.
This is a conflict of interest. I need another officer to come and assist with this scene.
Yep.
Same with the investigator. It's a small county, so I get it. Like, I'm sure a lot of people have a conflict of interest, and we're going to find Gene Myers is a very prominent person in the community. But find someone else. Mm-hmm. Call a neighboring police department. After speaking with the person that I know as a police officer, I kind of gave him the situation and the scenario, and I asked him, if that were you coming to your friend's house and there's a body, what would have been the protocol? And he said the same thing that I kind of suspected what would happen.
Yeah.
He would have to excuse himself from the case. If there's another officer on their police division that is not a conflict of interest, that's who gets brought in. Mm-hmm. If every single officer is a conflict of interest, then another department is brought in.
Which
you don't
sense.
Stop until you find someone that can come to this scene and not be a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
There's also body cam footage of Corporal Miller talking to Gene Myers' mother while assessing the crime scene, reassuring Gene's mother that everything's fine and that he and Gene have mutual friends, they know each other quite well, Gene's okay, there's nothing wrong, it's all gonna get worked out.
Dismissing everything.
So adding on top of letting key witnesses leave the scene of the crime, turning the paramedics away from the scene, there's now a clear conflict of interest before the investigation has even started. Each person that is now involved in this case has a personal tie with the homeowner and her boyfriend. So their opinions, they're not even just biased, they're just completely wrong. You can't look at a case with a clear mind if you're looking at it like, oh, this is my friend's house.
There's no way they would do anything bad.
Yeah, this poor woman woke up to find this lady dead in her backyard. I mean, it's just
not realistic.
Horrible. Once Tom's body was transported to Deputy Coroner Chris Shelton, even more injustice took place. During the autopsy, Chris Shelton took a very limited amount of photographs. I researched what the average amount of photographs taken for an autopsy is, and it's close to over 100. And that's just for like a natural death. Wow. So when they do autopsies for like homicides or unnatural deaths, things like that, I mean, it's way over that 100 mark.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
So
they want every little possible detail.
Every single. And I found that I think it's like 3 or 4 of those initial photos are a picture of the body bag, a picture of the tag with the identification on it, and I think it's like the picture of the person's face. So it's like those identifying markers. Like you have 3 that are always the same.
Yeah. Well, and it would also make sense because then you're like, okay, this set of pictures is with this person.
Exactly.
You know, that sort of
yeah.
thing, yeah.
So take into account that Tom's death was highly unusual and suspicious. So you would expect there to be hundreds of photos taken and all the injuries that they said she suffered from.
Mm-hmm.
You would expect there to be hundreds.
Yeah.
Only 5 photos
Only
were taken
5?
Of her body. Only 5.
That's crazy.
And remember, 3 of those, at least 3,
are
identifying
basic,
basic markers.
Oh,
so we'll throw them a bone and say 2 to 3 photos were taken of Tom's body.
I wonder of what.
When later confronted about the lack of collecting evidence and documenting photographs, Chris Shelton reported that his supervisor, Chief Coroner Lauren W. McDonald III, is the one that instructed him to take limited photos and that it wasn't necessary to take samples from under her fingernails or perform a sexual assault kit. Which, again, in any unusual death, is
standard.
It doesn't matter if you don't see signs of sexual assault. You still do it because you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren W. McDonald III was also the owner of McDonald and Sons Funeral Home, where Tomla Horsford had her service held. During Tomla's funeral, when her husband, Lee, saw her body in the casket for the very first time, he was horrified. It was obvious that someone had put almost like black shoe polish
on Tomla's
face, making her skin color look a lot darker than it actually was. And I know, I'm sure all of our listeners have heard this term, the blackface term. That is what was on her face in the casket.
And I am actually shocked by that.
There are multiple witnesses to this. Like, this wasn't just something that her husband said happened. People saw her face and were horrified.
That is literally crazy. What?
So, that's... Hold on to that. So, now we're going to circle back to the deputy coroner, Chris Shelton. He's the one that performed the autopsy, only took 5 photos. It was released that in 2014, Chris Shelton was fired from his position that he had at the time for racist behavior. He exhibited clear racist behavior during a case, so he was dismissed. The firing was covered up by an employee at the Sheriff's Department, which allowed him to be hired by Forsyth County and eventually be in charge of handling the autopsy of one of the only African-American women that live in Forsyth County.
That's,
yeah.
Oh, unacceptable.
I wish that I could say this was all there was with the corruption of this case, but just hang in there because we still have a lot to go through. Now we're going to turn to the initial investigator that arrived at the scene. Now this is all coming out after her case has been closed. This is all starting to come out now. People are like, nope, this isn't what happened. Injustice has happened here.
Okay.
So the family is starting to hear bits and pieces and things are starting to come
out. So who are the people raising the concerns?
We're going to get into that, but okay. I will say the main person that raised the concerns was one of Tomla's really good friends. She wasn't at the party. She couldn't go to the party. And we'll talk about her more in a little bit. But she's the one that advocated.
Okay.
Nonstop. That there were a lot of injustices happening. And she 100% believed it's because Tomla was African American.
Which, from the sound of it, it's, is correct.
Yeah, I mean...
Which is so sad.
It is. Because... Yeah. So now we're going to go to the initial investigator that arrived at the scene, Michael Christian. Michael Christian, after Tomla's case was closed, was subjected to an internal affairs investigation because of how he handled Tomla's case. Michael Christian was known for his extramarital affairs, so he had many affairs with many women. And on the morning of November 4th, 2018, when he responded to the crime scene, he took Snapchat photos of Tomla's body and sent them to one of his mistresses.
Oh, like...
And then...
Are we a professional or no?
And not only that, he referred to her as the porch lady.
Oh, heck no.
Which, when I first heard that, I was like, well, what does that mean? It's a derogatory term for African Americans. I had never heard of it. And then once I knew what it was even more mortifying. And then he continued to share details from the case with this mistress. So it would give them something to talk about the next time they were together.
How about you get a
life? Like, how... Jeez. Sometimes I just wonder how. How can you look at yourself in the mirror? How can you be any type of law enforcement and be doing that?
Well, and you're getting caught this one time. How many times have you done it prior?
Yes. How many other times? How many other cases have you given information, taken photos inappropriately? During his interviews with the GBI, Michael Christian was adamant that he actually didn't believe that Tomla fell from the porch balcony. He even went as far as to make claims that Jose Barrera had initially called another police officer named Andy Kalin before they even called 911. So Andy Kalin was an officer that eventually responded to the scene. He was, I think, the third or fourth officer to, like, arrive. And his relationship with Jose Barrera, everybody knew that they were friends. But again, it's like all of you had conflicts of interest, so what was one more?
Really?
But now it's coming out, according to Michael Christian, that Andy Kalin is the one that told Jose to check Tomla for a pulse and see if there were any signs of life. And Michael Christian believed that the partygoers that were left at the house, they panicked when they found Tomla's body. And they called Officer Andy Kalin to try to get their story straight before calling 911. Which would explain why the call to 911 seemed just so rehearsed.
And put together.
And put together really well. They didn't seem distressed. They didn't seem upset at all.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, but if I found someone dead at my house,
I would be freaking out.
Whether how much I knew them or not, like if I barely knew them, I'm still freaking out.
Yeah, it's like, what happened? Yeah. What's going on? Well, and then you're thinking too, like, I don't even know if my first thought would be, oh my God, she fell from the balcony. My first thought would be, did something happen to her? Is the person still in the house? Like, did somebody do something to her? The back door's open, the garage door's open. What's going on?
Yeah.
So if you were so taken by shock and surprise, it would have reflected in the 911 call. And it didn't at all. So I do believe, even though Michael Christian is a scumbag, I do believe that there is some merit to what he's saying about how they had called another police officer before even calling 911 to try to figure out, what do we do? How do we handle this? This looks really bad for us. Michael Christian ended up resigning from his position with the sheriff's department very shortly after his internal investigation was completed. I think he was just told, like, hey, this looks really bad. We got to let you go, which I don't think is enough, but...
Well, no, because like we said... If
he didn't get fired...
He got caught this one time. I'm sure he's done it before.
He just resigned. And one thing I have learned is, like, when a police officer resigns versus getting fired, it's because the department still is like, hey, we got your back, but we've got to save face, so...
You gotta leave.
We're just gonna let you go ahead and say that you're leaving on your own accord. But he maintained his innocence, and he said that if there was a cover-up at play... He had absolutely nothing to do with it. Which, not sure how much anyone's going to believe you.
Mm-hmm.
So the next person that became the center of an internal investigation was Jose Barrera himself. Because he abused his position within the court system that he worked at. Remember, he's like a pre-trial probation officer or something.
Yeah.
He accessed the case file related to Tomla's death. And leaked information from that case file to Gene Myers. Again, how you think you're not going to be, it's not going to get traced back to you. Like, we are not in, like, the 1960s where there's no computers and you just take a file out and then you read the file and, like, make copies of it. This isn't like Aaron Brockovich time where you're scanning all these files in. It's computer software, and they can trace it back to you.
Every single
little thing. And then he leaked it to his girlfriend. It's just...
stupid.
At this, and it just proves the point even more that you clearly had something. Like, you're looking at her case file after the case has been closed.
Well, not only that, but it doesn't only make you suspicious looking, but it just makes you look like stupid. Like, you are really
cocky
to the point you think you're going to get away with just looking
at
it.
Yeah, like, you think that your ties within the sheriff's department is going to keep you from being investigated for anything at all.
Yeah.
At this same time, this is where we're going to talk about Tamla's good friend. Her name is Michelle Graves, and she's an angel because she's the only friend in the circle, the only friend that stood up for Tomla, and immediately after hearing about her death, she questioned everything that happened.
Rightfully so.
But Jose accessed her case file information and leaked it to other people. And that is how everyone found out that Michelle Graves was the one that spoke up and said, I don't believe she fell from the balcony. I think that these people had something to do with this. So, like, they were
trying to create a witch hunt.
Yes. And she did receive threats. And she received a lot of, you know, anonymous messages. And it's all because Jose leaked that information. Michelle, like I said, she wasn't present at the party, but she knew Tamla very, very well. And she never for one second believed that this was just some tragic accident where she fell off the back porch balcony. And Michelle Graves is the one that has been advocating for Tamla. I mean, her family obviously as well, but Michelle has been right there with the family front and center advocating literally since like the day that her body was found. So all this injustice It prompted Tamla's husband, Leander, to request that an independent autopsy be performed. So about a year later, so November of 2019, Adele Shaker, a board-certified anatomic and forensic pathologist, performed a separate autopsy and found that the injuries Tamla sustained could not have been from falling from the balcony. Which, I know no one's surprised hearing this.
Yeah, like, shocker. I mean,
but I'm really glad that the family, they lawyered up. Once, I think, once they started hearing, and that was the thing, too, that was in so many reports, is that the sheriff's department tried keeping it very much hidden, mm-hmm. these internal investigations. They didn't want it getting out.
Oh, I'm sure they didn't. Because then you can't trust them.
So once they started hearing that, oh, hey, you've got this investigator did this really crappy thing, and then now you have Jose Barrera did this crappy thing, they lawyered up. And then the lawyer said, all right, it's time to get an independent autopsy performed. Let's get started on it. So I'm really glad that they started that process.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know you could do an autopsy that far after someone has died.
You can exhume the body. I mean, I'm sure there's some evidence lacking.
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot.
But this,
it does give you a good idea.
Yeah.
Things, though.
So Adele Shaker did not find significant injuries to the skull or bones, which completely contradicts Tamla dying from blunt force trauma to the skull and the chest. Like, that is literally what her cause of death is, blunt force trauma to the head and chest. But there were no significant injuries to her skull, to her head, to her chest, to her bones in general. Like, you're falling 14 feet from a balcony and it's killing you, your bones would have some type of trauma. Impact,
for sure.
There also was very little blood found at the scene of the crime. So just kind of like let that sink in too. You're falling, blunt force trauma to the head, there's going to be some type of blood. There was no blood.
Especially if the wrist was cut.
Right. And then that was the other thing. The like cut on the wrist, they said, I think the coroner said that it was a dislocated wrist. And that's what the cut was. It was like a dislocated wrist. It wasn't a dislocated wrist. It was a compound fracture. So compound fracture is where the bone sticks out.
Oh, wow.
Just for, yes.
Yeah, so I was like, I don't know what that means, but okay.
This compound fracture, would the way it was positioned, it would have had to have happened post-mortem. So after she was already dead.
AKA they threw her off the, maybe?
That's one theory.
Yeah.
Then it was brought into question how Tamla's body was positioned when she was found. So this one, you're going to kind of have to like really visualize it. I'm going to try my best to explain it. She was lying face down in the dirt with her legs were kind of like awkwardly pointed to the right. So like both of her legs were awkwardly pointed in the same direction. Crime scene photos show that her right arm is bent with her palm facing into the ground. And her fingers are curled underneath her palm. Okay. Jose Barrera and Jean Myers on the 911 dispatch call claimed that Tamla's arms were at her side and that her palms were facing up, like up to the sky. So when you fall down, what is the first thing that you instinctively do when you fall? Your hands go down. So when officers arrived, and her body wasn't with her hands, like her palms facing up, they did question, like, well, why does her body look like it's been moved? And Jose said, oh, well, when I checked for her pulse, I must have moved her arm. So, like, what did you do? You picked up her arm and, like, flung it?
Yeah.
And to check her pulse? Like, if her arms were at her side with her palms facing up, that's where you check for a pulse. You don't even have to move her arm.
Or under the chin, or, you know, like,
yes,
there's a lot of places.
A lot of places. But at no point should her arm have been moved
to that extent, yeah.
So she had a little bit of blood found on the sleeve of her left wrist. But the post-mortem compound fracture was her right wrist. And there was no blood.
Which tells you right there that it was definitely post-mortem.
Yes.
Because if she had gotten that while still alive, she would have bled a lot.
Yes. And even like falling from 14 feet, there would be blood. Where's Where's the blood? So Leander Horsford believed that with the help of his attorney, this was all more than enough information for the case to be reopened and reassessed. Because it was obvious that there were so many inconsistencies and so much conflict of interest and that it was handled so poorly. But yeah, it wasn't until 2020 when, I mean, we all remember with George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Then, and that is when Tamla, her case kind of got brought up again.
Oh, okay.
There was a change.org petition that was started by her friend, and it reached over 600,000 signatures. And there were so many celebrities that came out and said, hey, look at this case as well. Look at what's happening down here mm-hmm. in Georgia. Like, racism is alive and well. It's right here.
Yeah.
And the sheriff's department, because they felt that pressure, they decided to reopen the case and examine it again. Now, this is when a lot was revealed. This is where court of public opinion, a lot of it was out there in the open, and they were able to find out all of these inconsistencies, all of the conflict of interest. It just blew up, kind of. It was revealed that by the time investigators subpoenaed phone records for all the people in attendance at the party that night, so they didn't do it immediately, they took their time, more than two of those people had gotten rid of their old phones and bought new phones. And their old phones were just gone, destroyed, no way of being found. Like, it took you that long.
Literally. I mean, what were you expecting to find?
Right. Long enough where they had time to go get a new phone.
Yeah. And I'm interested in who got a new phone.
It's never revealed.
Yeah.
Which, shocker. shame, we know your name. I'm sure it's Tom and Stacy Smith. I'm sure that's two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that whole time they left the house and came back, they discarded their phones.
Probably.
It was also brought to light that Jean Myers, and this part blew my mind, she actually went onto her Facebook and posted that a tragic accident took place at my home, but that there was no fall from my deck.
What?
And was urging people to not speculate and spread vicious rumors. So she went on Facebook.
So there's a tragic accident, then what happened?
Yes. My thing, though, is her death was ruled as falling from the balcony, accidental fall from the balcony. That is what her case was closed. From what
you said happened.
Yes. And then it comes out that not long after the accident happened, she went onto Facebook and said, oh, no, she didn't fall from my balcony. You know, she tripped and fell and something tragic happened, but she didn't fall from my deck. That's not what happened. So how can the sheriff's department rule that her case is closed when you have the homeowner literally saying
no, that's not what
it
happened.
Didn't happen.
That's crazy.
And then furthermore, Jean was also caught on body cam footage saying that she had video footage of Tamla going out back to smoke around 1 a.m. But remember from part one, she told investigators that her cameras hadn't been working for weeks at this point.
I feel like she deleted footage.
There has been no footage found, and investigators still say, nope, her cameras weren't working. No cameras were working. But she was heard on body cam footage, and then Jose was also heard on body cam footage telling Jean to show them Tamla walking out the back door.
Yeah, I don't believe – I think they deleted it.
I think they deleted it, and there's a lot of stuff.
I think the cops didn't care enough to look into it, and I think they deleted it, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm. And what really stinks now is we're in 2024, and I think it was last year in 2023, Jean Myers sold the home, so it's not even her home anymore. She sold it. Not that that would, like, I guess, really do anything, but it just means, I mean, she's not there anymore. So yeah. The next revelation that a lot of people question, and this was Tom's friend Michelle, she's the one that brought this up, and she pushed really hard for it, is that there was Xanax found in Tamla's system, but she didn't have a prescription for it. She'd never taken that medication before. And Xanax, just for anyone that's not really sure what it is, it's an anxiety medication. A lot of people take it for anxiety attacks or to help maintain their anxiety. It's prescription only, and it is a controlled medication. So it's, like, heavily followed by the DEA.
Yes, and just to go off of that, my husband's on Xanax. He takes it as needed. He has to get, like, drug tested almost every time he gets it because it's so controlled.
Yep.
Well, not only that it's so controlled, but he has a good doctor, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because then, like, my other friend also takes it as needed and never has once had a drug test. So,
yeah.
Depending on your doctor. But anyways, like Spencer, it makes him tired for 2 days. Mm-hmm. Not to the point he can't operate a vehicle or things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, it definitely calms yes, you down.
Yeah, and he's like, I sleep so much better.
Well, and you can see how it can be abused. Mm-hmm. And you can see why it's controlled.
Well, and if you're on Xanax and it's mm-hmm. making you sleepy and then drinking on top of that, I cannot imagine. Because, like, Spencer doesn't drink alcohol, period. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even drink soda at that. So, I can't imagine him taking that and then and, drinking.
Yes, having that as well.
Well, and even smoking weed. I don't know. Right. How, I don't all know how that would affect it, but I can't
But imagine. Having, like, all that in her system, right. Mm-hmm. One, so Tomla didn't have a prescription for it, but one of the partygoers did, Bridget. She was adamant that she never shared her medication with anyone and that she was very smart about it because it's a controlled substance and, you know, yada, yada, yada. Hear it all the time. Yet, investigators were able to uncover text messages from her phone that proved that that night at the party, Bridget shared her Xanax with none other than Jean Myers and Stacey Smith. I'm just going to let that sink in for a minute.
These women are crazy.
So, like, how... My thing is, Bridget was the last one to see Tomla alive. So now I have, like, so many questions. Here I'm thinking, oh, Bridget, sweet Bridget. You know, left when her husband picked her up. Like, whatever. But now, it's like she's the one that gave Xanax to Jean and Stacey. And Xanax like, was found in Tomla's system.
And did they give it to her? Did they drug her?
Did they drug her? Did they, like, heavily intoxicate her? I mean, I have so many questions.
Well, and I'm wondering how much Xanax they gave her. Because, like I said, it makes Spencer, which, by the way, my husband is 6'5".
Yeah.
He's a big dude. So, him taking two, like, he I don't know the milligram, but it's not high. It's pretty low. He takes two, and it affects him for 2 days.
Yes.
So think of a woman.
Like half of the smallest dose that you could have.
And that would affect her tremendously.
With and then, alcohol and marijuana in her system. And now, so now my problem is that the last people to see Tomla alive were Jean Meyer, Jose Barrera, Stacy and Tom Smith, and Bridget Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
And Paula, who's still, Paula left at 7:30. She left before Tomla was discovered. I mean, still sketchy. We'll kind of just, like, put her to the side right now. And then there was another woman there, Jen, but she was so heavily intoxicated. She was passed out in her room before, like, anyone left.
Yeah.
So, but these five were the last ones to see Tomla alive and be with her. And now these five are the ones that it's coming out now that Bridget had the Xanax. Jean and Stacy took some Xanax. Stacy and Tom were reported urging and trying to keep Tomla from leaving. You know, it's just, it really is starting to paint a really ugly picture. And something clearly happened that night and one of them knows. But
or all of them.
Yeah. But reopening the case and it receiving nationwide attention, it became very clear to literally everyone in the country that these women and men would do whatever they needed to do to lie and cover up what really happened at the party that night. And it just kind of makes me think of, like, that saying, the old boys club, like the whole old down south thing, that these, they're living by, like, the rules of the South that are very old, that no one else lives by or in the real world.
They're, like, just wrong.
And yeah, and they're just protecting each other and they're doing everything they can to just cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
After performing another investigation, the GBI came to the same conclusion and did not change their ruling. So even though all of this new evidence was made public and all of this these new things came out, the internal investigations of the investigator and Jose Barrera, all of that came out. And even Jean Meyer saying she didn't fall from my balcony, she like somehow died, but I don't know how. They still said, no, she fell from the second-story balcony accidentally, and there's no foul play involved.
Which is crap, because they could at least do unknown.
Right.
Like, they don't have to do a cause of death.
And they've never even come out and publicly, like, apologized for how they handled the case. It's almost as if they're saying, like, yeah, we reopened it to try and save some face because all of these celebrities and people were crying out loud for it. But now that we reopened it, nothing's changed. It is what it is. And I just, that's just such crap. So their family attorney, Ralph Fernandez, he has stated that he's going to keep continuing to dispute the ruling and bring the case forward to receive justice for Tamla. But as of today, in March of 2024, there hasn't been any additional progress made. Nobody's come forward with more information. Each lie and inconsistency that has been found has been very much like haphazardly explained away by investigators and witnesses, with nobody trying to push for a better explanation. And I just want to say, I mean, I think we all, there are so many theories that we could go through them one by one, but we'd be here all day and it would just be us circling around.
Yeah.
So I think it's impossible to go through like every single theory that's out there. I think to me, the most plausible one is that Tamla may have accidentally overdosed. I don't know if it was malicious because I don't know these women. I can't really speak to their character.
Yeah.
But if Bridget was handing out Xanax kind of like a party favor and gave one to Tamla, and Tamla's never been on it before, it's not totally inconsistent. Like, she could have overdosed. She could have, with the alcohol and the marijuana in her system, and even like smoking a cigarette, it could have caused her to overdose.
And yeah, then rather, I also could say it could have caused her to be so relaxed that when she drank it, she may have thrown up and like choked on it.
Exactly.
But because they didn't do any autopsy,
right,
in reality, that we would never know if she did that.
And I think rather than calling 911 and just saying, oh my God, this happened, these literally like band of freaking sisters and brothers of the South here are trying to cover their tracks and protect each other. So I think that they either threw her body off the balcony. I think they threw her body
to make it look like an accident.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or they somehow moved her body. I don't know. But for her to have the injuries that she did, she clearly had some type of fall somehow.
Yeah. For sure.
But I think that, I mean, that's just, to me, that's like the only theory I can think of that kind of would like make the most sense. But again, there are some people that believe that she could have been the victim of like a hate crime, and that mm-hmm. she could have been murdered, and that this whole party, when it was the end of the night, these people are just like horrible racist people
and covering it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
So just like I said, there's so many theories out there. That's kind of the theory I go with. I do wonder if it was like an accidental death and then they just went out of their way to cover it up because they're all trying to save face. But it's very clear that an entire sheriff's department is made up of nothing but corruption.
100%.
And even the state, even the GBI seems to be laced with it. And that's like, I hate cases like this because you see so many law enforcement officers that aren't corrupt.
Yes.
That aren't horrible. They do their job. They look in the mirror every day and they're proud of themselves because they're doing the dang thing. They are fighting for justice. They're doing what they need to do and they're trying to keep everybody safe. But then you have a case like this and it just makes every law enforcement officer look bad. It does. It makes you stop and think.
It makes you
when
question.
You look at a police officer. Are you corrupt or are you a good one? Mm-hmm. Are you a bad one or a good one? If something were to happen to my family member, would you...
Do I trust you right. to do what you're supposed to do?
So I just... It's very unfortunate. I 100% believe she was murdered. Do not believe it was an accident. Whether it was an accidental overdose or whether it was...
they're covering up something. Those
something
two
is covered
that
up.
Went, the Thomases that went home and showered...
The
and
Smiths.
They came, or, I'm sorry.
Stacey Smiths, and Tom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of that guy's name. The Smiths that went home, showered, and then came back.
They
and, like, left on yep. purpose before the cop. Like, that's just very weird.
It is.
And I'm wondering, was that ever looked at? Did their clothes ever be were their clothes ever examined? Like, what?
No one would. Jean and Jose both went on record saying that they couldn't remember what Tom and Stacey were wearing when they left, which is, like, such crap.
Like,
so
get the hell out of here.
And that's what I mean. They're
show
all,
this video that you supposedly are talking about.
Right. So they're all covering up each other's tracks. And then there were pictures and videos from that night. And when they talk about like, oh, well, here's what you were wearing. Then Tom and Stacey, it's just like, again, though, every single time someone questions, well, where were their clothes? It gets explained away like, oh, Yeah, no, they ended up changing. Those weren't the clothes they were wearing when they left. Like, those clothes were different clothes. It's like, okay, but then what happened to those clothes?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh,
are they in the washer? Because that's suspicious.
Yes, like, it's like, oh, I don't know where they went. Everything's just kind of met with, like, resistance. And I just...
And they just take that at face value, which is crazy to me.
Yes. So...
Because we all know if they were a person of color, it wouldn't be the same way. If they were all people of color and then one white person, the white person died,
it would not be... It would be, like, a witch hunt.
Yeah, like, it get would out be, of here.
Yes. It'd be all over the place. And that's just... It just breaks my heart for this family because they lost just such a beautiful... person. She was a wife and a mother, and her stepdaughter had a baby on the way when she passed away. It's like she had such a beautiful life.
Well, and to lose your mom over something these people had a game with her, whatever the hell they did to her, like,
well, and like her poor sons to not know what happened to their mother, but knowing that her color played into how her case was handled.
Hopefully,
it's mortifying.
Hopefully, they moved.
That, I don't know. It doesn't ever say. I do believe they did. I don't think they stayed in Forsyth County.
Yeah, there's
just
no way.
Because I wouldn't. Heck no. I'd be gone.
I'd honestly be scared, too.
So would I. And even Michelle, her good friend, she ended up having to kind of, like, relocate because she was receiving threats because
I'm sure
she was raising all these questions, and that's not what you do down in the South. You protect each other. And I just, it's just very sad. Like I said, this case has been covered quite a few times by a lot of, you know, like, other podcasts, and there are so many theories out there. I mean, I dove really deep. I covered, like, everything. And I think that there was a tragic accident. I think that they're covering it up. But there is also that part of me that, it's like that part that you don't want to entertain. There is that part of me that believes it was intentional. Mm-hmm. That it could have been, like, a hate crime.
Yeah.
And the way it was
intentional.
The way it was handled. I do not believe that there will ever be justice for her. I don't think that they will ever push it enough. Anybody that raises their voice and questions anything, or anybody that tries to say there was injustice served, we need to look at this, we need to fix this, I guarantee they will be fired.
Or silenced.
Silenced. Threatened. However, whatever they need to do to keep it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's how it's going to be.
Yeah, I agree, unfortunately.
And I think it's because, like I said at the beginning of this episode, Forsyth County is still very well known for its racial segregation and its racism.
Like, we're in 2024, people. What are we doing?
When I looked up Forsyth County, it brought up a list of cities that I will make sure that I, like, never go to because they still actively practice, like, racial segregation. It's still a thing.
Which, how is that even legal?
There's a lot in Texas.
That's so scary.
It is. Again, we're from Ohio, so I think we're kind of, like, naive in a way because we don't, none of that is around here.
That we're aware of.
That we're aware of, yeah. Like, that we see.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's racism everywhere. I see, you know, we see racism, I would probably say, not every day, but, like, often.
Yes.
But to that extreme, no.
Well, and then to find out that there are still, like, active little towns and counties that if you are not even just a person of color, but you are, like, transgender or gay, or you're anything but a white person,
straight person,
they you feel threatened. That's... You feel my hairdresser, great man, he's gay, and he went and taught, like, a hair class in Texas, and he was in one of these small towns, and he stopped at a gas station just to get some snacks before driving, I'm assuming, like, to the airport. And the clerk, and he dresses, I mean, you know, you when you see him, you know that he's gay. And the clerk at the gas station told him to be safe out there. Like, how you can drive without, like, speeding to get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
So it's like, to me, when I hear things like that, I'm shocked because it's just not something that I personally deal with every day. So the fact that there's still all of this happening and we are in 2024, it's just devastating.
It is.
But I don't think that we're ever going to find out what happened to Tamla. We will never know for sure.
I don't either, unless I wish I knew what pictures they took of her, because I wonder if she had crazy bruising or cuts or things.
I do believe that some of those pictures were released. So if they were, like, we can post them to the discussion board.
Not too terrible.
I don't think they are. I think the only ones they took were, like, your basic identifier ones. So, but I mean, we'll post what we can.
Yeah.
But if you or anyone you know has any information regarding the death of Tomal Horsford, please call the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. I mean, I guess you could call them. I don't know how much help they would be. 404-270-8572. But I also urge you, like, if you know of anything or you think of anything, there are so many resources that you can go to, like change.org. There's a lot of websites that are advocating for Tomla, and not just Tomla. There's a lot of cases where it's very clear that because they were African American, their cases were handled horribly. So we appreciate everyone listening to this lengthy episode and hanging in there while we discussed our theories and thoughts. As always, thank you for listening to Crime Connections. If you so kindly would please follow, share, and go like us on Facebook at Crime Connections, or follow us on Instagram at Crime Connections Pod. If you have any news, tips, or cases you want us to look into, please feel free to email or DM us, and definitely hop over to our discussion board. We'll post about this case and let us know what your thoughts are, what your theories are. Like I said, there are so many of them circulating around the internet. Go ahead and just pop it in the Google search. Let us know what you think.
Yeah.
We love hearing from you guys and sharing all this with you. So thank you.
Thanks, guys.